Today's episode is presented by Clark's. Clark's story began almost 200 years ago when Cyrus and James Clark made a slipper from sheepskin. At the time, it was groundbreaking, a combination of invention and craftsmanship that's remained at the heart of what Clark's does. From the very beginning, Clark's has always thought differently. Brilliant ideas are what set Clark's apart. We are teaming with Clark's and Podgo to bring you up to 30% off on select items, including on the iconic Clark's Desert Boot, by going to podgo.co/Clark's. That's podgo.co/Clark's. Welcome to A True Crime Murderific Journey. I'm your host, Bernadette. Stay tuned after the show for promos, patron shoutouts, and phone calls. Remember, horrific and murder equals murderific. Enjoy the show.
Content warning. The Murderific True Crime Podcast contains offensive language and will have information about kidnappings, torture, murder, and sexual assault. It is inappropriate for children or the faint of heart.
Alaska, a land of wilderness with miles of forest, the bluest of blue lakes, and snow-covered mountains. Many people move to Alaska to escape the 9-to-5 materialism of life. Some people move there to be alone, or they don't want to be found. Maybe they go in search of more out of life. McCarthy is where people go for isolation and to be free. McCarthy, Alaska was a very remote town. In fact, in 1983, there were only 22 inhabitants. A fairly new arrival to town, Lewis Hastings, came up with an idea to fly to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and kill himself while blowing it up. But before that, he would kill anyone in town who could identify him as the culprit. This is the story of the McCarthy Massacre. Welcome to another episode of Murderific. Please stay tuned to the end. I will have a promo from Jules from Riddle Me Podcast and Robin from The Trail Went Cold on a podcast that they're doing together about the death of Nathan Landine. Thank you to my guest, Casey, for joining me today.
Howdy, folks.
It's been a while since you've been on.
Apparently.
So what have you been doing with your life?
Mostly what you tell me to do, which is generally editing podcasts every night, posting podcasts, and the occasional sweeping the floor. And
oh boy, you're doing, so...
doing a dish.
You're suffering so much.
This COVID got me bad.
This is an episode that you wanted me to do for a very long time, Casey.
Thanks for writing it.
Yeah. Casey was supposed to write it, but 2 years later, I wrote it. That's okay, though. He's going to help.
You know, it's one of those deals where I don't like to be forced to do things like writing your podcast.
You make it sound like you're in this room with like a chain on your neck and you're being forced to edit.
It's too much pressure. I did the Ray Carruth one and I mean, that turned out okay, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. All right, let's get started. Let's talk about the history of McCarthy, Alaska. It is located in eastern Alaska, a small mountain village in the mountains. The only way to the outside world is on the McCarthy Road, a 60-mile road to Chitna.
Chitna, we'll see, is actually not much larger than McCarthy itself, with just over 100 residents. The next closest big city, though, is Anchorage, and that's over 300 miles away on the McCarthy Road. That's the closest city with modern healthcare, modern dental care.
Wow.
Walmart. All the normal conveniences you and I have. You know, think about being a pregnant woman in McCarthy. There's no doctor's office for a routine visit. It's a 300-mile trek to get any type of care.
So the McCarthy Road is a rough road with large potholes and narrow one-way bridges. And forget about using the road to get out of town in the winter. It is closed off due to snow and ice. And the only way out is via plane. You must go through McCarthy to reach Kennicott, which is another close town. Carper was found in Kennicott in 1900. Well, that's what you read, but in real life, let's be real, centuries ago, Athabascan natives collected copper nuggets from Dan Creek near Chitna, where they camped. But in 1900, Kennecott Mining Company came along and started mining the copper. 5 mines were built, and in came the people to work there. By 1916, the peak year of production, the mines produced copper valued at $32 million, and that's back in 1916. Kennecott was a dry town, meaning no alcohol, so the men working there would go to McCarthy to drink alcohol or to find sex workers.
Kennecott, just to put it in perspective, is about 4.5 miles on the McCarthy Road, north of McCarthy, and it is the literal end of the road for the McCarthy Road.
McCarthy grew at its most to 120 inhabitants. But in 1930, all of the copper resources were gone in Kennecott and McCarthy, and they both became ghost towns.
Almost overnight, they basically said, "This is the end of the copper. We're all getting out of town. Here's the last train out, whatever. We're gone."
The railroad track that they used to move the copper ore became, as we mentioned, McCarthy Road, which fell into disrepair. And as we said before, in the winter, it is impassable. By 1983, there were only 22 residents in McCarthy. And every Tuesday, in came a mail plane. This was the only way to the outside world. As in 1983, there was no internet. McCarthy had no telephones, no electricity except from generators, and no running water. Also, there was no law enforcement in McCarthy. Everyone would get together on Tuesdays to talk and eat and maybe gossip.
Why Tuesday? Because that was the day that the mail came in.
Right. One of the inhabitants' names was Lewis D. Hastings. He was born January 1st, 1944 in Kansas. He loved animals very much. His father was a World War II vet who psychologically abused his son before he ended up leaving the family. Lewis served in the Air Force, and then he became a computer programmer. Lewis was an environmentalist who once volunteered to clean birds due to an oil spill off of the California coast. This had a huge influence on the rest of his life.
Lou married in 1979 to Madeline Stovall, and they honeymooned in the town of Kennecott, Alaska, the old mining town. They became obsessed with Alaska and up and quit their jobs in California and moved to Anchorage in 1980. Lewis had a computer business, and the couple bought a summer home in Kennecott, McCarthy area. The computer business started to fail, and Lewis started spending more time in McCarthy, in the cabin they had, and Madeline would just stay in Anchorage. The marriage began failing also. Eventually, Lewis was living in McCarthy by himself. He didn't like the fact that the Trans-Alaskan pipeline was happening in his area. It angered him that he came to Alaska for land that was supposed to be undisturbed, and the pipeline was there. Lewis bought guns and more than 2,000 rounds of ammunition. He killed rabbits and used the fur to make a silencer. The pipeline started in 1975 because of the 1973 oil crisis when oil prices spiked in the United States.
TAPS, as it's called, is one of the largest oil pipelines in existence. Of course, there were many an environmental and legal objection to this oil line that would pollute vast Alaska. The project brought tens of thousands of workers to Alaska, increasing the population in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and other towns. The pipeline is 800 miles long. 380 miles of that is buried underground. As feared, there have been many oil spills over the years. In fact, it is 500 spills a year that occur in the oil fields. Some of the pipeline walls now have lost up to 80% of their thickness because of corrosion. The environmental fallout still continues to this day, as the pipeline crosses over 800 streams and 3 mountain ranges. You can imagine the destruction to the land, to the environment, because of this pipeline.
Money. It's all about the money.
There's your history for today about the pipeline and that area in Alaska. Back to Lewis. Lewis made a list of 200 political and civic leaders with their phone numbers and addresses. Lewis was withdrawn and quiet, living in his unfinished cabin about 4 miles from the airstrip, where everyone gets their mail. He was described by neighbors as, quote, "emotionless and standoffish." unquote.
That actually makes sense. A lot of people are there in that region.
They want to be left the fuck alone.
By themselves.
Yeah. Maybe he didn't want to be friends with people. On March 1st, Tuesday, mail day, 1983, Lewis Hastings started his murderous plan. He went to Chris Richards' home. Chris invited Lewis in for coffee. Chris was 29 years old and worked construction in the summers. Chris was making his breakfast with no electric appliances. He looked away from Lewis for a second and he felt something hit his right cheek. His glasses shattered. Chris felt something hit the top of his head. He turned around to see Lewis holding a rifle right on him, and they began to fight. Lewis told him, quote, "Look, you're already dead. If you just quit fighting, I'll make it easy for you," unquote. Chris mentions later that he didn't hear the gun go off at all. Chris got a knife and stabbed Lewis in the upper chest and right leg. Chris Richards ran for his life in waist-deep snow while bleeding, wearing only socks, one slipper, t-shirt, and corduroys. He ran about a mile while Lewis was still shooting at him. Chris made it to a cabin where he grabbed boots, a coat, and snowshoes. He then walked to the cabin of Tim and Amy Nash, who were newlyweds.
So this is Alaska in March, freezing temperatures. Chris had to run in the snow with no shoes on for a mile.
Yeah, to his nearest neighbors with no police and no phones. Scary. Tim was 38 and Amy was 25. The couple helped Chris with his wounds and he told them what Lou had done. Chris told them to arm themselves and then go to the plane runway to warn anyone who would be coming to get their supplies and mail. I can't get over this, how isolated they are and have to rely on each other right here to get out of this situation. Amy and Tim Nash put Chris, who is very wounded, behind them in their snowmobile, and they drove directly to the airstrip. There, they met Gary Green, a local pilot who was cleaning off his plane at the time. Green said that he saw Lewis Hastings going towards the Heglands. Les Hegland was 64, and Flo Hegland was 58. They had lived in Alaska for 27 years. The Heglands is where everyone went on Tuesdays to wait for the mail and be together. The Heglands had the only two-way radio strong enough to contact the outside world.
So this is how remote the place is. The Heglands were the place where everybody flocked to because they were the closest to the mail stop, aka the runway, the airstrip that the mail plane came to. And Gary Green, he is a bush pilot, and he was featured regularly on a TV series called Edge of Alaska that I got into. And he mentioned this particular day on that show. And it's just a great show from the Discovery Channel that followed McCarthy residents around for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, starting in like 2014. So, and do you know why they're called bush pilots? Because they operate in the bush.
What kind of bush?
The Alaskan wilderness. They actually don't have runways in some areas. When they go out hunting, they have to land wherever it is in the terrain.
So all four of them came up with a plan that Gary would take the plane with Chris Richards, who was injured, so that he could get medical help, and that Tim Nash would go back to check on the headlands. As Gary was still heating up his plane and loading the injured Richards, they noticed Tim running down the airstrip. Tim said that he had checked on the Heglands. While Tim was there, he saw blood all over the house and gun smoke, which means he just missed whatever happened if there was still gun smoke in the house. Tim saw Lewis Hastings on the back porch, and Tim fired his gun at Lou, hitting the doorknob. Lewis shot back at Tim, hitting his right leg. So then Tim took off and went back to the plane. They all decided the Nashes would stay at the strip to warn anyone what was happening. As Gary took off in his plane with Chris, finally, he radioed the mail plane that was coming in at 11 a.m. and told him not to land. Down at the airstrip, Lewis Hastings had made his way there and shot more than 10 rounds at the Nashes. He walked closer and shot 2 rounds into their bodies as they were on the ground. He then walked right up to their bodies and fired into both of their heads. He then tried to hide their dead bodies in the snow.
They were just sitting ducks for Lou Hastings.
Right, but can you imagine if it wasn't mail day? There would have been no plane, no one to get help.
That was the reason why Lou Hastings selected that particular day. Oh. He knew the mail was coming in. He knew all the residents were going to be there, and that was part of his grand plan.
We're going to introduce some new people into the unfolding situation. Harley King and Donna Byron arrived on a snowmobile at the airstrip, and they noticed the blood on the ground. And as they saw it, Hastings started shooting at them. Donna Byron saw bullets hit Harley King and the snowmobile. Harley and Donna were still on the snowmobile, and it accelerated, and then Harley lost control of the snowmobile, and his leg was broken. They were both thrown from the snowmobile. Lewis came up on them fast. Harley told Donna that he couldn't move and to save herself. She ran away and heard Hastings shoot Harley King twice. Donna kept running until she got to the Heglands, where everyone was going, but she noticed the door had been kicked in. She hid outside the greenhouse while Hastings stalked her. He was walking around saying, quote, "One not dead, one not dead," unquote, which is literally terrifying.
I just couldn't imagine all the confusion. You know, people are going in to get their mail. They don't know what's going on. They see blood. Their assumption isn't that there's a terrorist on the loose shooting people. They have no idea what's going on, and all of a sudden they come in, they're getting fired upon.
As Donna was holding her injured arm, she could hear Lewis's boots on the ground walking near her. Lewis finally gave up and drove off on the Nash's snowmobile.
That's straight out of a horror movie.
Yeah. The first state troopers showed up in an unmarked helicopter and saw Lewis Hastings heading west on the McCarthy Road. As they landed, he waved to them and told them that he was Chris Richards and that Lewis Hastings had gone crazy and was shooting up the place. But the authorities knew Chris was getting medical attention in the town of Glen Allen, so immediately the troopers arrested Lewis Hastings. Nice try, though.
It was actually pretty clever, but unfortunately he used the one name that he couldn't of the whole village. Now they had to look for survivors, and they found Donna Byram, as she was injured, and they had to take a 40-minute helicopter ride back to Glen Allen with police and Lou Hastings, the murderer.
What? That is a crazy situation.
That's got to be pretty awkward. When police got to the Heglin home, they found Les and Flo Heglin and Maxine Edwards in the bedroom, quote, unquote, stacked like cordwood.
Oh, God.
There was a bloody fur silencer next to the bodies. Tim and Amy Nash lay dead in the runway. Harley King was found dead near his snowmobile. Lewis was charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder and assault in the first degree when he was arraigned in Anchorage, Alaska, March 3, 1983. He had no plea at the time, and he was held with a $300,000 bail bond. A psychiatrist said that Lewis considered himself the savior of the Alaskan wilderness. December 5, 1983, Lou was planning on the plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, but instead entered a no-contest plea. The judge, Ralph Moody, found Hastings guilty and set sentencing for July 27th the next year, 1984.
Louis Hastings received, altogether, 634 years, 6 99-year terms to be served consecutively. He was held at Leavenworth in Kansas. He's now at Spring Creek in Arkansas. Lewis is 77 years old. His victims, Maxine Edwards, Harley King, Les and Flo Heglin, Tim and Amy Nash. The victims that were injured but survived are Donna Byron and Chris Richards.
How delusional was Lou Hastings to believe that he was the savior of the Alaskan wildlife?
Right, even if he had sabotage that one section of the oil pipeline, that's one section of 800 miles.
His grand plan was to drive a rented van filled with explosive material and gas enough to blow up the Alaskan pipeline. But he first needed to kill all the witnesses, people who could identify him. and that was the McCarthy residence.
So he's going to kill himself. It sounds like kind of the typical, my life sucks, so I'm going to hurt everyone I can before I go out. That sort of scenario, doesn't it?
His intention to save the Alaskan wildlife was good. His method to do so, obviously, was delusional and convoluted. He neither saved the Alaskan wildlife, nor did he even get the chance to crush the Alaskan pipeline and kill himself in this maniacal fashion. Somewhat ironic.
The town tried to fix their community from the attack. They had meetings to fix their old trams so they could get out of town if anything like this ever happened again. They received $90,000 from the state of Alaska. Residents put all the work in, cutting logs for support towers, designing the tram cars. Within 2 summers, the new trams were completed. Gary Green, the pilot, says, quote, "We felt like a community that had accomplished something and was together. That was a healing catharsis. You bet it was," unquote.
Gary still lives in that community today.
In 1997, the state put in footbridges to get to McCarthy and let some tourism into the town. Of course, McCarthy is the town shown in the show Edge of Alaska on the Discovery Channel, which Casey mentioned, which was on from 2014 to 2017. You still can watch it today. It focuses on the 42 people living there and all the risks that they take day to day to be truly free. You love that show. You watch that all the time.
Binged it. Watched it more than once. But it was highly scripted, like most reality TV shows are. And what was interesting, though, is you can see the progression of the town from this isolated place to a place that became more commercialized over the years. They created a new hotel somewhat recently to accommodate all of the tourists for the Kennecott Mines.
The photos for the Kennecott Mine, I have to say, are like, it looks like a place I would want to visit because the mines were up on a hill and they're red and it's just very dramatic looking. You know what I don't like about that show? Like, you'll watch it and they'll be on the ice and you'll hear like the ice crack and they'll be like, commercial. And you come back and like the noise they made was fake and no one ever falls through the ice.
That's kind of what I alluded to. The series is really good, but definitely highly scripted and embellished quite a bit and sensationalized and all of that.
They'll be in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden their snowmobile will stop working and it's becoming dark and I'm like, this is fake as fuck. And that is the end of this mass murder story. McCarthy, Alaska still has no hospital and no law enforcement, but I'm sure that everyone carries a gun now, and they are much more wary of outsiders in their small community. Thank you to my guest, Casey, for your contribution to this episode.
Thanks for writing it. I really enjoyed this episode.
Thanks for watching all those Alaskan TV shows.
Every day.
See you soon for another Murderific. As always, I want to give thanks to our executive producers, Mike T., Beth Ann L., and Christina B. You are making the show possible. And thank you to our new patron, Eleanor L. Stay tuned for our promo at the end, and see you soon. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the Murderific True Crime Podcast. To support the show, join our Patreon and hear the regular podcast early and ad-free, plus get some fun merch or buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com. You can find both of those links in our show notes or at murderific.com. Of course, you can rate and review Murderific on iTunes, which is free and an easy way to help others find the show. Or tell your friends, it really helps. All sources for episodes will be in the show notes. Until next time, we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
Craving this awful, raging, eating feeling inside. I could feel it consuming my inside, this fantastic passion. It was overwhelming me.
Hi. Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime.
I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold, and Jules and I want to tell you a little bit about a case that means a great deal to us. The death of 9-month-old baby Jacob Landine on April the 10th, 1987 in Socorro, New Mexico.
The day prior to his death, on April 9th, baby Jacob was being watched by his mother Brenda's new boyfriend John, not his real name, in his mobile home on 1453 Fatima Drive. While John was babysitting Jacob, Jacob would incur what would be his second head injury in a period of weeks. The prior head injury was a subdural hematoma, or brain bleed, and it was serious enough that it needed to be lanced to take pressure off baby Jacob's brain while being monitored by doctors over the course of several days.
The circumstances surrounding how Jacob was injured and subsequently died are murky at best, with the suspect giving multiple versions of the events of the day, ranging from Jacob choking and accidentally hitting his head while trying to dislodge a cookie, to Jacob falling and John returning to see the injured infant.
The suspect also reportedly confessed to officers that he was indeed responsible, but there is no paper or audio record of this confession in the police file. The reasons given by the DA for not pursuing the case are confusing as well, with one of the reasons being that they were worried that John would file charges against the state.
It was the opinion of the doctors that baby Jacob was struck in the head and this was no accident. In the years to follow, John goes on to sexually abuse young Eric, as well as physically abusing his mother Brenda and emotionally abusing and isolating them both, making the world very small.
During the autopsy, layers of abuse seem to be present. A healing rib fracture from around the time of the first head injury is also discovered. It's impossible to say exactly when the injury took place, but what is clear is that someone was abusing young Jacob, and that person was most likely John.
Eric Landine, Jacob's brother, has been fighting to get justice for him. However, he faces some obstacles, such as the statute of limitations of 6 years on second-degree murder that State Representative Bill Rehm has petitioned to have overturned.
Join Robin and I, as well as criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman, an investigative expert, a legal expert, a forensic psychiatrist, as well as Jacob's brother Eric, as we explore all angles of this case and try to bring awareness, understanding, and hopefully, ultimately, justice for Jacob.
The series starts on March the 1st. Tune in on your favorite podcast app.